This transitional period for David and Saul in some ways, even though Saul's already passed. But before we begin our study, I would ask if everyone would bow with me in prayer, please. Heavenly Father, we thank you for tonight. We thank you for the time we share in study of your word. We look for times of joy and rejoicing in our lives, recognizing that while suffering is part of the plan in our spiritual development by your will at times, and that the world itself brings its own sorrow to our doorstep, there is great joy to be found in Jesus and to be found in your kingdom. Help us then to share the joy with others and to lay up treasures in heaven. This is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so again, we are in the text of 2 Samuel, particularly chapters 3 and 4. Last week, when we were looking at all of this, we kind of paid attention to two things that initially we thought we might spread out a little bit further, but I compressed them together, and we looked at the new king, and then the anointing that went through that process, and a little bit into the aspects of mercy that are present in David's stepping into this role. He's a much more merciful person than Saul in that regard, and we took some time to kind of explore 2 Samuel chapter 1 and a little bit of chapter 2 with that dynamic change there. Tonight, though, we're going to be looking at chapters 3 and 4, and as we do that, I want to try to emphasize a couple of key things that maybe you noticed in your readings of this Bible story. One is that there are some similar structures in this David, Abner kind of back and forth where you see this, hey, it looks real similar to me. That's a really common thing in the overall patriarchal narratives. It's a common thing in what you might consider the primeval histories of Genesis 1 through 11, which is all that time before the patriarchs, Genesis 1 through 11, a lot of repeating themes and ideas there. But also it reappears in the broader Torah, the first five books, and it also appears in some of these historical sections, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and 1 and 2 Kings, where sometimes it's like the same story again with some slight changes. When that happens, there's a couple of things to pay attention to. One of them is really obvious. When there's a difference, pay attention to the difference in the story. So if you've got a 2 Samuel 1 and a 2 Kings 1 or a 2 Chronicles 1, and like, hey, this is the same thing, what's different? And then ask yourself another valuable question. Why? Why is this one different? Here's a great parallel to you. Are there differences in the way that people behave or see events in the Gospels? The Gospels are very much a first-person narrative where someone's describing kind of what they see or what God told them to write. And a lot of times they write of the same event, but from different perspectives on the playing field. They see what they see, another person sees what they see. And those differences create the whole. But yet, God didn't ask them to merge them together. He didn't say, put all those accounts into one account. The Gospels are each of those four independent books. Even though around the 5th century, a guy actually took all four of the Gospels, smooshed them together, and made a version of a Gospel account that had every single word of the other four. And actually, it was like the most popular book to write about amongst believers for about 600 years. They used that one as a primary text. So kind of notice that as these things go step to step and kind of catch this. And by the way, if you're participating with us online, feel free to drop your comments, your questions, and I'll be able to respond to those in the class as well. So right now, let's take a moment and look into what we've got right here, which is this shift that's going to take place, because you're going to go back and forth from information first about David's house, his family, and then a shift to some things about Saul's house and family in the text, and how those dynamics kind of go up and down. So let's start by reading together verses 1 through 5 of 2 Samuel in chapter 3, and it reads this way. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron, a firstborn. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Chileb of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmi, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth, Shephathiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream of Elga, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. Quick question before we go into depth. Do any of those children of David seem familiar to you based on the rest of the Bible's message? Like, do we meet many of them a whole lot later? Couple of them we do. Some of them we never hear of again. This is the last time for some of them. There's lots of possibilities could be going on there. And by the way, this is kind of like a pivot point in the text where the narrative is shifting from the close of some of the physical fighting stuff that had taken place in chapters 1 and 2 and the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And now you can think of it as the scene widens. And so it had been narrow on individuals. And now the writer is saying, okay, now back up a little bit and see this big picture. And I want to point out a couple things here that I think is super important to see and understand some of the questions that I have about the text at different times, and maybe you do as well. So number one, do you notice that there's a lot more women involved in these relationships than we had to begin with? A variety of women. Now, it's important to note that it looks like, from the way that their names are presented to us, that these marriages are very much similar to the marriages that would have existed in any monarchy, because they're equally political as they are about progeny. So it's not just about an heir. It's also about, we're going to tie our nations together. And to do that, I'm going to take a wife from this other king. And one of them is very clear. Like, this is a totally a political relationship. Does that change what you think of David at this point? And it's fair to say yes or no. Because the yes side might, wait a minute, David should be following what I understand Jesus to teach in the Gospels about the singularity of marriage. And David doesn't seem to be doing that, right? He's got multiple spouses. But is he different than any of the patriarchs at this point? How many of the patriarchs were singular in their marital relationships exclusively? And you can use either a mathematical specific answer or generalizations. If you can remember one who was, your mind's working faster than mine did, and even when I was preparing for the class.
I don't know if it said anything about Lot ever having more than one. That's the only one I can think of.
Right, and some of it is in the realm of, it just doesn't say. But of the ones where there's specificity, it's almost all had a combination of marital relationships that exceed one. Some of the men who we would consider patriarchs, and I might include one of specific note, and that's going to be Boaz and Ruth. That's the only one that I came up with. It was like really definitive. And his is actually a Levirate marriage of a type. He is marrying to carry on the progeny, which is a little bit different, because some of the marriages that we know of that go from David forward and David back might fall into this Levirate category of raising up children, including Nabal's child here. It's very likely that Nabal's child isn't actually in the Davidic line. It actually is in Nabal's line to keep up that connection to the property, to the land, etc. I'm trying to remember if there was any harem / Levite, like any of the other second-class spouse statements that come. I don't remember one. And let me add a comment about that. Like, you may not have heard that terminology, second-class wife. It literally means what you think it might mean. in that they are wives, but they are second place wives. That means at least two things are true about them. Their children are not the firstborn in inheritance. And they are treated exactly like you would expect. Sometimes the terms are used, we might use a mistress, but this is a legal mistress as opposed to an illegal mistress, rather than the wife. You actually see it in the text of Judges, where there's a woman who's given that state, even though there's not mention of a primary wife. These are things that occur in the text that we have to think about and grapple with and say, now, how does that change your opinion of the person or what's going on? Remember also, he's a king. And that does influence what he inherits and what he gives to his successors. Because who gets a big giant harem when he becomes king? Solomon does, and he adds to it. Bobby? All that was there present. Culturally and realistically, the law was available to them. The question is always, did they practice it? And there's something interesting about a lot of the historical king-focused stories that take place when we get into the Samuels, the Chronicles, and the Kings, is that it really just talks about them. And a lot of times, both cultural Israelite life is forgotten, and spiritual or textual rules and regulation aren't practiced, even by people who God values and uses, like David. David was valued and used. And it never spends time, for the most part, explaining away or giving insight into the why. Like, it's just not interested in that. For any number of reasons. What we have to then do is to say, okay, like Bobby pointed out, what was the law? What should have been the standard? What should we then understand out of it? Does that justify behavior? And it never does. But it may help us understand a key thing. Simply being a king didn't make it okay, even though you could get away with it. Further, simply being a king in this context didn't mean you were perfect. And in all of these, I tend to view it this way, and you're free to disagree or agree. These kings, whether they are righteous or unrighteous, going up and down, are always incomplete. They're always insufficient. And what's lacking in them is made up in Christ. Christ presents the genuine picture of a king that was absent in even the best kings in Israel. And that's why he is identified as King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and has that appellation attached to him of being the penultimate offering as the text of Hebrews enters. And so I think that's my look at it. Like, you're going to see all those flaws, and even the ones that are not so much highlighted. So you have those women who have the background that's most clearly and obviously a mix of things. And some people, are quick to catch and say, okay, here's some political ones, here's some other ones. But there is a clear concept being laid out that's began in verse 1. Even though David is the anointed king, Saul left behind a power vacuum. It's pretty normal. All the people who followed him, are they just going to be like, hey, you know what? David's king now. Let's show up. It's interesting. I've had friends over the years who have run for the office of sheriff in their counties. And a lot of times when the new sheriff is elected, a lot of the people who worked with the old sheriff leave and go to new departments. There's all kinds of reasons why. And a lot of them are very healthy, good, reasons that make sense. But on a practical level, they worked for the old sheriff. They built a relationship with the prior sheriff. When the new sheriff comes into town, we don't know what's going to be like. Am I going to be favored or disfavored? Am I going to be treated poorly? Now's the time to go get a new job with the new sheriff and be the guy that's been brought in by the new sheriff in town rather than the one who is working with the new guy. That's a little bit of what you see here. But there's also conflict about that, because there's a level of war that's taking place as David establishes and gathers in his kingdom. Because if you remember, and we talked about it this way before, David is going to majorly push out the boundaries of the power reach of Israel. I don't know if you've ever watched those shows on TV that talk about aircraft carriers, and they are projections of power. How do they do that, by the way? How does an aircraft carrier project power? Because it's really just a flying landing strip or a floating landing strip.
Where they position themselves.
Right, so we've got a number of them for the United States, and we move them around like chess pieces on the board. And then when they're there, you can draw a circle. And that circle represents a couple of things around them. But basically, that's how far those planes can fly. That's that circle. And they represent might. Because at the ordering of the military forces and the president, they can extend that arm and go as far as it can go, and that's their extension. Well, that's how it is with David. But it's not as if those who were loyal to Saul woke up and went, we're good with that. That's part of what you see taking place in this shift. And so you have that rise of one and the fall of the other that brings us to a point where David's power base is expanding, and very much in the context of how a king, but also the people of Israel, saw a lot of things. The key factor is he's having sons. He's developing the potential to create the dynasty that would be clear to kings, but none of these end up being the one that it goes to, right? None of these are going to be the one who inherits whatever it is David will accomplish going forward as we read through the text. Picking up now in verse 6, chapter 3. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David, and yet you charge me today with fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more so, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul to the throne of David, over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. Abner's power seems to come from his ability to move the mighty men who are underneath Saul. And he's a warrior in that context. And you see something that happened a couple other times prior to this. It'll happen otherwise. But in essence, this move is really a move culturally and structurally in the text, a move to say, I have power. And he's moving into a place that says, I'm now trying to be equal and above you, Ishbosheth. I want to be a king. I want to be acknowledged. It had taken place earlier in the text. Reuben takes Jacob's concubine back in Genesis 35. Absalom will appear in 2 Samuel. And there's also the other thing, Abner returning Michal to David is part of this whole thing of who has the right to the next place on the throne. It's a very similar event that history shows a lot of this as well. This is a huge thing because now it tips the scales. So before, it was one's getting stronger, one's getting weaker. But now you see them shifting sides. And that's an even stronger pull, because it's one thing just to get stronger, but it's another thing to have the weight from one side of the balance beam leave and go to the other. And so now you have another layer of strength, and now this one particularly is the power edge of those things. And you'll notice in verses 12 through 25, exactly what he says is exactly what he has happened. Is that a pretty common thing in history, to see the scales kind of push a little bit and get close enough to the edge that someone says, you know what, I'm changing my vote. I'm going to the other side. Happens a lot. Nations, happens in debates about policy for small and big things, where people pick the winning side. And they do so not because of divine reasons at times. Sometimes it's simply because they want to be on the winning side. Because it's a lot better than being on the losing side from an earthly standpoint. You saw a lot of that over the course of the development of America as we gradually expanded from colonies to states to 50 United States. A lot of these small shifts moved in that same way, both in America proper and the nations around it, but you're seeing it now in Israel as well. That kind of pushes us all the way through in the story arc to about, say, verse 21, 25 or so. Before we dig back in the text in verse 26 in particular, though, any questions or thoughts that you noticed in those first two big chunks of chapter 3? Our big five questions will still appear at the end, so you can get ready for those. All right, so picking up here in chapter 3, verse 22, when Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers from Abner, or after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah, but David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Ashel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his house, his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous and holds a spindle or falls by the sword or lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Ashel to death in the battle at Gibeon. Is that a pretty stern curse? You think about that for a second. There's something super interesting in the Old Testament that's regular, and there's a layer to it. So in the Old Testament, it seems that when God blesses or curses someone, like in the very strict language, it's basically permanent. His blessings stay and his curses stay, which is different than consequence of sin or rebellion or chastisement, but true curses, like the curses from the garden. When this language is being used here, we're left with a couple of things to really grapple with. Number one, okay, does David have the right to do so as king? Because a lot of what's being said there, is that within his control? Can he cause it so that your descendants would always have a discharge or accidents? So on a literal level, that may not be the best reading, right? Like, that doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't mean it's not possible, but it doesn't match the rest of our understanding. Second level in the text. Does David ever talk like this anywhere else about his enemies?
Yeah, all through Psalms.
Right. A lot of the imprecatory Psalms are really big on David asking God to curse, condemn, destroy his enemies. This is a challenge point on a spiritual level to think things through, because some of the things that are discussed in David's Psalms and in the statement here are pretty harsh. And we realize that the Psalms form the basis of our understanding of one edge of worship to God, particularly for Israel. A lot of David's Psalms are written as worship psalms for approach to the temple for sacrifices, but not all of them. Some of them are more private prayer messages. So you think about, okay, so here I am, I'm a believer in Jehovah, and now I'm a believer in Jesus. How striking is the change from being an Israelite to being a disciple of Christ considering just that detail, like what David prayed like, but now what Christians are encouraged to pray like. Is there a big shift there? Yeah. We sometimes talk about how maybe it would have been difficult a little bit to give up your habits of Sabbath or cultural idiomatic Judaism because it was common behavior to not eat this or not do this. But it's more than that. The whole nature of your relationship of God and with your fellow man shifts. Because when your king prays like that, what do? You move that way too. If your king behaves in a way, whoever your king is, and if your king is Jehovah, you move like Jehovah. If your king is like David, you move like David. And if your king is like Jesus, who is more than David and the representation of Jehovah, then you're going to move like him. Well, that's part of what you're seeing here, is that we get to see the heart of David at this transitional point when he's moving into a more powerful position. And it's not a big surprise, because his psalms have that same kind of harsh message. And it's one that really has descendancy in play, because he's basically saying, your descendants are this close to being snuffed out altogether. Like, they'll live, but they'll never actually thrive. And remember the way that they pictured their spiritual realm, especially as a kind of a storytelling thing, that you go to your fathers? Well, he's basically saying, when everyone sees you get to your fathers, they're going to see how poor off you are. Because you're going to be broken. You're going to have bled your entire life. You're going to have tripped and fallen. You're a failure. It's all of those awful things. Because of rebellion, for sure. But because of all of that, you're kind of seeing the scope of the condemnation. That brings us to the last parts of chapter 3. Where Abner and Joab are kind of reconsidered in some of this a little bit, but begins in verse 31 for us right now. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier, and they buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept, and the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one who falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, "God, do so to me and to more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything the king had did pleased all the people. So all the people and all the Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zariah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." Now, there's a couple of things that kind of come to mind as you read the text, and I'm going to lay a few of them out on the table. Part of this reads as propaganda. Look at how good of a king I am. Everyone loves what I did. And then he comes back and says, "I'm not as severe as those guys." It doesn't mean it's not true. It doesn't mean it's not accurate. But it's a form of persuasion. It's like, look, I'm the good king. Is that something David's done up to this point? Has he behaved that way so far in our reading of David, where he has proclaimed who he is? He's announced his status as anointed. He's the anointed of God. He's accepted the crown of king, but he hasn't truly sought it in the ways that some might. Because he was allowing the prior anointed of God to come to whatever end was there. But this is a shift where David moves from receiver to leader, receiver to speaker. And the approach that he's using here is very rational and reasonable, but it does have a tone of, hey, I'm really the good king now. And again, like, it doesn't mean it's not true, because it is. By contrast to Saul, He's way better. And yet, it's still harsh and strong and forthcoming with what he had just declared earlier in the text. I also point out this. This whole segment here, if you think about a lot of the key elements that have taken place about judgment and justice and pleasing the people, take this event from the life of David and Abner and Joab here, and notice when we go to the cross, does any of this reappear? Are all the people pleased when Jesus is brought before them for punishment and the choice is given between Jesus and Barabbas? Well, yeah, they are pleased. The point to catch is you can have those literary parallels and see the same behavior in people, but the big difference is, I would say that what takes place here in 1st or 2nd Samuel is justice. Where what took place with Jesus, the counterpoint is it wasn't justice. It's a reminder that we can be pleased when justice takes place. We can be in agreement with justice, whatever that would be. And by contrast, we can certainly be displeased or upset when there is no justice. Both of those things are certainly legitimate within the context. We've got a little bit of time to insert chapter 4 as well. It's just a few verses in the fourth chapter. It's not as long as some of the other stuff, but it deals with Ish-bosheth, who is one of Saul's children. And the text there begins verse 1. When Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Banah, the other was Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth. For Beeroth also is counted a part of Benjamin. Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there to this day. By the way, that's like a side note that this is being written after these events, and so it's written about some point in the past. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled, and as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Now the sons of Rimmon and the Beerothites, Rechab and Banah, set out, and about the heat of the day, they came to the house of Ish-bosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came in the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rahab and Banah, his brother, escaped. When they came to the house as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night and brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and his offspring." But David answered Rechab and Banah his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversary or adversity. When one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hands and destroy you from the earth?" As David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and their feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So on one level, as the text points out, really similar, right, to what happened to the person who brought the news of the death of Saul. Like, look, this is like already played out before. And that person was simply lying about what happened. He had tried to capitalize or been opportunistic. These two, nothing like that. Now, I want to point out a couple of things. These individuals here were heads of raiding bands under the kingship of Saul. They're captains in charge of others. Leaders of men under the kingdom of Israel as led by Saul. Does that tell you a little bit about Saul's choice and who he puts to work for him? Well, it does. But then you have David's response to it. Is David a man of war and a man of blood? Well, absolutely. Like textually, he's called that. But here we see it in a practical way. Is that pleasant to read through? Not at all. At least not for me. Like, that's not a pleasant read. But it's a powerful one. Because even though David is a man who's like any other person, and we've already begun to kind of see some cracks, in, if you will, in the moral armor of David so far, he's consistent. He's like, look, I did this before. Here's your reward. You want a reward for this. This is what that reward looks like, and your blood is required. A couple of textual tie-ins, aside from the connection to the first part of 2 Samuel chapter 1, is all the way back to the expulsion from the garden. The comment is made, his blood cries out. This kind of helps us understand that from the garden to the time of David being put on the throne of Israel, they understood and recognized that blood had value. And the guilt of blood taken unjustly had a consequence. And that's when you would end up with concepts that are discussed sometimes, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that kind of tit for tat level response. Well, it was something that was known to them, and David is leading from a space that says, hey, here's what we need to do, and here's what it looked like. And so these are the outcomes of this behavior. And so that kind of closes this narrative spot in chapter 5. David's throne is going to come into play, and that'll be part of next week. But right now, let's talk about our common questions. We've got five common questions that I like to kind of touch on in our study. And first and foremost, in chapters 3 and 4, is it tough to find things to like? Did you guys find anything that you liked?
Attention to how someone's going to react when I go to them and tell them something. And to follow that up, what question do I want to answer? I don't actually know if Abner was guilty of what he was accused of. I don't know if he was mad because he was caught or mad because he didn't do that.
Yeah, my presumption is that he was mad because he was caught, is my reading of the text. Although I could see how you could read through it in different ways to kind of see, like, is this an overreaction because he was caught, or a reaction because he didn't do the thing he was accused of? Although I read it like he had actually done it. And the things I liked about the text, I like the consistency of David's behavior, even amidst everything else being inconsistent. His response to this kind of behavior, that's something that you can say, okay, that means that this king is stable. And Saul was not stable. And so in David, you're getting stability. Further, you see there is a standard that David appeals to. We may not always know it or see it or recognize it, but he has a standard. I also like seeing a little bit more detail of David's life in different ways. Understanding here at the beginning of the text, he's got marriages of convenience or for politics that are marriages. Helps me understand a little bit who he is. It also helps me understand some of his writings later in the Psalms when he talks about things that may not necessarily include a singular look at his life, which is looking at one event at a time, but now we're seeing everything. And so we see some of that too. And it also helps me understand Solomon too. Because Solomon's doing what David did when he steps into the throne. It's like, this is what we do as kings now, apparently. This is our thing. What questions do you want answered? Michael already ran ahead of us a little bit.
Point of view, and correct me if I'm wrong, you I have struggled trying to understand two different characters here and the behavior, the similarity and the dissimilarity. They were two different men, but yet they were both anointed by God. And what was the criteria? What made them worthy of being anointed?
In a short order, these are things that, like, and God doesn't give us all the answers to your question. I do have some answers that I've come up with for part of it. And I've said it this way before. Saul was the king they wanted, but not the king they needed. And his big downfall was when he stopped doing king things. David wasn't the kind of king they wanted, but it was the kind of king they needed. But he also had a big downfall when he stopped doing king things. Solomon, you can say the same thing. A lot of people like a king like Solomon. They want a king like Solomon. But he still even wasn't the king that was needed later, because the king that was needed later was Jesus. Right? So with Saul, God chose him because he was needed at the time. He was useful. People wanted him, but he was needed to accomplish the answer to the request. They wanted a king like the nations around him, around them. Saul was a king just like that. And so God gave them what they wanted. David was the king that God chose, but it wasn't the king that they picked. And so they were both anointed to serve as tools or vessels for God, but they were not perfect. They're not anointed that means, oh, this is the best thing ever. It just means God's going to use them. Think about Barak, Samson, Deborah, every single judge, Joshua, they're all at different levels useful in the service of God. But some of them are really bad, and some of them are really good. Some, you look at the final gasps of Samson. Read the close of that text, and who does Samson thank for his strength? And who is he happy about? It's not Jehovah. He's happy that he gets to kill more Philistines. But he does so by the power of God, and God later in Hebrews says that that was a matter of faith, but we see that his faith is corrupted by his self-centeredness. Where in Philippians chapter 2 and Paul's writing, Jesus is the counter to that. And so there's a lot of that going on. And there's also a lot of stuff I don't know. Like, I don't know why Saul is the one, and I don't know why God answered their request. Because sometimes God doesn't answer people's requests. And sometimes he says no. What do these stories teach us about people? Michael?
I don't know if this is totally accurate. I'll preface it with that. What does it teach us about people? When I see David's reaction the first time, people thought they brought in news about somebody dying, they thought his own life. And David's reaction this time, we see the same pattern. I think we look at people, and while we can change, I think if we look at somebody at 25, they're probably going to have a lot of those qualities at 45. So you can look at somebody and kind of tell who they are, and they're going to react that way. And I told Stuart recently, I said, if you show me a lazy man at 25, I'm pretty sure I can show you a lazy man at 45. It's going to be that person. You can look at a person's behavior and see who they are. Now, can they change? Absolutely. We can look at somebody and see the fruits of what they do and tell who they are.
Yeah, a lot has to do with like the willingness to change. There's a difference between being changed by an outside force and choosing to change by an inside decision, which is different than being transformed. These are all different things. And I think there is a little bit of that. And David does change over his time. He sometimes has ups and downs, just like all of us. He makes failure. He makes success. He gets old, and his body fails him, too, towards the end of his days. And so you see some of that, just as it was for Solomon and just as it is in Ecclesiastes. But you do see that people, habits we have, become habits of whom we are. And you see that a little bit of David, too. What do we learn about God or Jesus in the larger narrative of the Bible here? Is God even talked about in this part of the text in a positive way? He's mentioned. He's mentioned actually in like big, like, bold statements and curses. Well, may the Lord do to you what has been done to others. And are any of those things blessings, or are they all bad? Pretty much, what was that, Bobby?
Yeah, blessings when we've done the right thing.
Right, if we're on the good side of the kind of setting and David is cursing, it may be a blessing to him in like the echo back. But he's cursing people for the behavior because they've behaved poorly. But if things are consistent, when David behaves poorly, what should he expect? He should expect the same, and that's the nature of the covenant. The covenant is built in that blessing-curse model in that concept as well. And so we see God is present in the text, but he is not the active pusher at this point in the open sense. Much in the way as it is in the text of Esther, where God isn't the open pusher of events, but clearly is somehow involved. What do you learn from this part of the Bible's history, in this narrative, this kingly or monarchy narrative? What do we learn? Or what did you learn? We've hinted at some. We've hinted about consequences and behavior.
We all have choices.
Yeah, life is full of choices that we don't necessarily recognize as choices because we feel like, well, I didn't have a choice. But you always do. There's always a moment where you can choose to act, react, or be inactive in all of these things. And so there's a lot going on here. Next week, we're going to be looking in to chapter 5 and going forward, chapter 6 and a little bit in that chapter. Really talking about David's true step to the throne. So we already know he's in the anointed of God. We already know that God has promised him the kingdom. But now he is being situated as king. And things are going to shift. He's going to move his focus from one of gaining power to using power. Some of that's for the good. Some of that will be the groundwork to create the foundation of the temple. And there'll be much more of that going forward. So look forward to 2 Samuel chapter 5 and chapter 6. Encourage you to read through that section of the scriptures going in advance of our study next week. But at this time, if you would, bow with me in prayer and we'll close out our study. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for our time to study and read your word. We specifically note the recovered health of many who have had all kinds of trials and difficulties, from Jimmy Roberts, who is well known to the church here, to Roy and to others who have had various ups and downs over the last couple of weeks. We're so thankful for their recovery. We want to continue to see your blessings in our lives, to be strengthened by your word and your will, and please forgive us of our own sins and to help us to be better servants and better followers of Jesus. This is our prayer in his name. Amen.